Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Julian Voss André, highly accomplished German-born sculptor based in Portland, Oregon, known for his large-scale public and private innovative sculptures that intuitively connect science and art. His blend of figurative sculptures with scientific insights into the nature of reality have been exhibited nationally and internationally in galleries and art fairs, and his works may be found in prominent collections in North America, Asia, Europe, Africa, and Australia. Julian studied quantum physics and philosophy at the universities of Berlin, Vienna, and Edinburgh, graduating with a master's degree, and then studied at the Pacific Northwest College of Art in Portland, Oregon, graduating with his Bachelor of Fine Arts. Julian's sculptures and writings have been published widely in such world-leading journals as Leonardo and Science Magazine. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Growing up in Hamburg, Germany, you always showed a deep fascination with science and art, studying both at the university. What was the starting point for these two lifelong passions of yours to capture your imagination and come together in such uniquely designed, innovative sculptures that have intuitively connected science and art so closely?
When I was a small kid, I would love to play with Legos in my sandbox, and I looked at everything very closely. So I always had the artistic hobbies and the more scientific hobbies, chemistry and electronics, but also pottery and stuff like that. So, and also in my youth, I read a lot of these popular science magazines and books, and I was really interested by that, especially relativity and weird stuff like that. And that kind of laid the probably foundation for kind of my lifelong interest in science and how far can we get when we follow that logical reasoning path.
What was the first public art piece you did, and what is the story behind that?
The first public art piece I did was in 2004, it was installed. That was during my years at the Pacific Northwest College of Art. It was part of my thesis project, and at that time was really interested in protein structure. That actually started my passion for sculpture, because I found a way to turn the backbone structure in 3D space of polypeptides, of proteins, into cutting instructions to make them into or represent the proteins as mitered cut sculptures. And so on that path, I realized if I just take a steel beam, I can do the same thing. I had an idea for what I wanted to do for a large public sculpture. And then at the same time, I realized that I got really intrigued by the whole protein structure, by the biochemistry of proteins, which is a big part of how we function, how we respond to the world. I learned that Linus Pauling, in addition to many of his achievements, was also the one who predicted the element that reoccurs in many proteins. It looks like a spiral, and it's called the alpha helix. I also realized then that Pauling was born and raised in Portland, Oregon, and he is the only person to ever win two unshared Nobel Prizes, and his house is pretty close to my house on the street here, but there's no plaque, nothing to commemorate him. So I reached out and thought maybe there's an idea to do a piece based on this alpha helix element as a memorial for where he used to live. He's dead by now, in the 90s he died. And I connected with people who were interested in his memory and had bought his old house, his childhood home, where he used to have his laboratory as a nine-year-old in the basement, actually. And the original idea was a little too crazy and too expensive. But then we made this very simple sculpture, 10 feet tall, out of one steel beam that I just cut up into my mitered cuts and rearranged it in the shape of an alpha helix.
How important is the color in the works that you do when you're taking the scientific ideas to the art form?
It's a good question. In my youth, I've been really interested in drawing and painting when I was like 19, 18, this kind of age. But I have never really looked into sculpture. So I was a total newbie at sculpture. And when I enrolled in art college without really knowing what I was going to do, I suddenly got interested in the protein sculptures. And the idea of color, I was very innocent about it. Today, people go like, oh yeah, it's like that's modernist and that's this and that's that. For me, it was just a way to express how I felt about it. And so number of works in this protein body of work ended up being red, like a blood red, like a Ferrari. Somehow this made intuitive sense to me because it's so elemental and so basic. But later when I got more into metal and more into the subtleties, I started liking patina, which is just an oxidization of the metal surface, a lot more. I stopped using colors to a large degree. Every now and then I use colors still.
There was a sculpture in particular that you were able to use the patina and show how it changed, and it made a difference to the effect of the overall sculpture.
That's right. You're probably talking about the hemoglobin piece. The idea there was I use steel that's called weathering steel. It's a high nickel content steel. It looks just like normal steel. You shined up, you sand it, so it's a shiny metal surface. But then just like normal steel, it rusts. But unlike normal steel, it stays outside like this because it doesn't go away. When it rains on it for like a few decades, normal steel is gone after a while. And that steel stays. It just coats itself with an oxidization layer. And in this case, it was depicting a hemoglobin protein, which, by the way, has a lot of these alpha helical elements. So the idea was to mimic or to mirror what happens in our body when we breathe in the oxygen connects to the iron atoms inside the hemoglobin. And that's the vehicle gets shuttled around the body that way. So the oxygen reaches every part. And so the same, very similarly, chemically is happening on the surface of the sculpture. The iron connects to oxygen and changes the whole appearance. I installed it shiny, took very good care not to get it wet. And then it was unveiled. And then I took a sequence of photos to show how it gets darker and browner.
Another earlier sculpture you did was the Angel of the West. Perhaps you could tell us about this piece.
So Angel of the West is also from the protein body of work, and it's based on the structural data of a human antibody molecule. It started by people at the Scripps Institute. They opened a new campus in Florida. Usually there's the one in California, but they opened the new one in Florida, Jupiter, Florida. And they wanted a sculpture there. And they were really interested in something that had to do with an antibody. And I was like, whoa, that's a huge thing. It has like almost 1400 amino acids. Each amino acid corresponds to one piece in my style. But the more I read about it, the more I got intrigued. It's an amazing thing. It looks like a big Y and has these two waving arms that basically adjust to click on to any pathogen it finds, where the end of the arms would be where the fingers would be, are the so-called hypervariable regions where all the changes happen when your immune system gets used to a new, let's say, virus, for example, coronavirus or whatever. And so the analogy, it goes pretty deep from the human body to the body. So I explored that direction because there's the torso and then there's the arms and the fingers. So it all has an analogy in that image. One time when I brainstormed about it, I tried to see what would happen if I take one of those data sets. That's another story where that came from. But it's a composite data set. Half the big parts were actually experimentally discovered by X-ray crystallography. And the hinge region in between where the solar plexus would be if it was a human was modeled in that case. But in any case, I superimposed it on the Vitruvian Man by Leonardo, which is 1490, I think. He drew this famous man in the circle in the square. And I was kind of blown away by the fact that it fit exactly right. Of course, you have to scale it up by a few orders of magnitude, but without distorting it anyways, it really fit that image of the body. So I decided to take the antibody backbone structure and use the ring as if it was a human in the Vitruvian Man image. And structurally and also aesthetically, I used rays that support those arms or angel wings. And they all point to the point in between the eyes if there was a human being in there, which there isn't. But there's a very subtle way of alluding to that Vitruvian Man image that's so iconic and so well known. The title was a play of Anthony Gormley's piece, Angel of the North. I'm a big admirer of Anthony Gormley. And here's this giant piece in Gateshead, UK, Northern England. He has the giant standing figure based on his own body. It has this wingspan of a jumbo jet, actually. And it's enormous and an amazing piece. And it's the Angel of the North, probably because it's in the north of England. And for me, I just loved that idea to call it Angel of the West, because West, not so much West in the US, because on the, in the East, but in this case, the Western approach to medicine. We have this miraculous molecule, which are actually like angels. They prevent us from dying on a daily basis. And I felt that it was a good way of marrying the Western intellectual scientific approach over the past centuries with the idea of an angel to take care of us.
You also created a number of figurative pieces that focused on the nature of quantum physics and led to some interesting experimentation and discoveries. Can you tell us about the quantum series and the process that evolved for these works?
The quantum figures, I made actually a whole exhibition that was at the Institute of Physics in Maryland, but the main body of work there are the sliced pieces, and they're called quantum sculptures, or there's different ways of calling them. But the original idea came when I was doing my graduate research in Vienna, and we had these weekly breakfasts for experimental physics with this whole group. And the PI, Anton Zeilinger, who is a well-known quantum experimental physicist who was leading this group, he made a joke, which is kind of hard to even tell because it's so physics funny. And so he basically said, oh, it can't possibly be a coincidence that a human being with this weight of a human being and the speed of walking of a human being has the de Broglie wavelength of the Planck length. So the de Broglie wavelength is something you assign to any object that moves through space that has to do with its weight or the mass and the speed. And so that's the quantum wave of a particle. And the Planck length is one of those fundamental numbers in physics that is thought to be the smallest distance where physics stops making sense beyond that. So I'm not going to explain the joke. It's not funny if you're not a physicist, really. But he connected these in a joking way, all these different things. And so I immediately start thinking, if I think of a human being as a quantum object, that means, okay, I am like this particle going through double slit experiment. I am moving through space, I have a certain mass and I have a certain speed. Well, that's true. It does turn right into a de Broglie wavelength, a quantum wavelength, which is really, really tiny. But I've imagined, what would this thing look like? And so I came up with this idea of a walking person, walking man, sliced up, basically a way of showing the wavefronts. If you move through space, the quantum object consists of wavefronts that are perpendicular to the direction of motion. That's just the basic thing in quantum physics. And so I kind of made that thing for myself because I want to see how that looks like a sculpture that is a human quantum object. So I made this giant 8-foot tall thing I carved out of styrofoam. Then I physically sliced it up and traced each slice and turned it to steel and then connected them with the gaps in between. And so then I realized the weird thing is that this thing actually looks solid from almost all angles, but at that one angle from the side where all the pieces of steel, you view them on end and you see mostly the gaps, mostly the air behind it, the stuff behind the sculpture, at that point, it seems to look transparent, seems to almost go away. You can do that even more when you take, instead of dark, mild steel, you take stainless steel, just shiny and sparkling. And so that's a bizarre experience that I didn't really expect. And that had a lot to do with the idea of quantum physics, that everything is critically dependent on the point of view, even though it's the same thing in nature, from two different points of view or asking two different experimental questions, you get possibly even contradicting answers.
Oh, that's just amazing that you see right through it and it's like it's not there.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And especially in stainless, you know, the light zigzags through the piece because they're parallel. And so you look at an angle and there's a car behind with light. You see the light traveling through it, even if you never have an image of that car directly. It's strange.
What role does light play in your creative process? And how do you incorporate this element in some of your designs and sculptures?
You know, I think a lot when I make a public piece or a commission that's outside, I think a ton about where's north and where's south and east and west, and where does the sun go? And I use websites that tell me where's the sun at what time of the year. So that I think a lot about, but I actually don't think a whole lot on purpose in my design process about light. In fact, I don't even use like fancy rendering. I don't like to be, which is basically pretending it's light, because I like to just have a sense for the structure itself. It's like a painting. You have the most basic stuff. It's just the dark and light pattern. You know, that carries the whole composition. And then the color is icing on top of the cake. And in sculpture, it's really about that 3D-ness of it. And then the light brings it alive. But when I design it on purpose, don't actually consider that.
What about the sites that you locate your pieces in? Does that have an impact, or the landscape where you're putting it, or it's a similar thing?
Totally. It's a mix of being constrained and being free. And free is nice because you can plop something there. But constraints also really nice because the constraints have this quality, at least for me, to creative stuff. I like that quite a bit when I have something I have to work with.
How do you use technology in your process?
I use it a ton. In the beginning, I made a lot by hand. Now I'm doing almost nothing by hand myself. My job is mostly being on the computer. I've used a whole bag of different tricks. I use a lot of 3D scanning. In that department, I use structured light scanning as well as photogrammetry. Both has their good and bad things. Then I use virtual reality for design. Only pretty recently I started that, which is a really wonderful tool to put your body into a virtual space. Then I use the mouse, of course, designing in 2D, which is a huge part of actually my design work, especially for the quantum type pieces. And I also use graphics tablet. Also pretty recently I started that, because if you draw by hand, it's a very different and much more accurate than you can be by with a mouse. Sometimes I use clay or 3D printing. You know, like one workflow I have, I design something roughly, then I 3D print it in small, and then I use clay to modify it, and then I rescan it, and then I use that as a starting point to modify the file in the computer. There's all sorts of very different ways. But these days, you know, the sky's the limit. It's just amazing time to be a sculptor.
If you take your sculpture into an art historical context, are there a few of the modern artists that may have influenced your work?
As I said, I really like Gormley, and I'm not sure about influence. In the early days, I decided to not look at his work anymore because I felt it was too similar. That is an idea I had, and I wish I hadn't known that somebody had tried, so I couldn't do it anymore. And I had that same when I was drawing. I had this one German artist, and my head was so full with art history that it hindered me. So I actually don't really do that, because doing that side path in science really showed me how beautiful it is to not be bogged down by knowing too much. Sean Plenza is another person where I feel kind of, okay, that's a sculptor right now. And he is interested in very similar things, but it doesn't have, to me, the quality of feeling influenced. I feel like I'm in my bubble, and then I see people who I have a relation with. There's a resonance.
And in July, you unveiled your sculpture, Transparent Man, in the city of Fürth in Germany. Would you like to describe this piece and how it came to be and the process behind this sculpture?
Yeah, that was an unusual process, actually. The client is a developer in Germany, and he just called me out of the blue and said he would like a sculpture. He had something in mind, a kneeling woman in that case. And so after we chatted, we felt it would be more fun to do something new. He was really intrigued by the, I don't even know how it came about, but somehow we ended up with the idea of a bust. And I had always shied away from that till then. In fact, now I'm doing a whole lot of them, but because I felt it's not right to reduce the body to our head, because we do this all the time anyway. And so I was really interested in the body. But since then, this was like 2 years or so, maybe, I've been thinking a lot about the head. I feel really good doing it. I don't feel like, oh, I'm denying the body. So in his case, he was really mostly interested in the idea of transparent human being, as in modern Western medicine. And for me, it was, the piece was more about introspection. So it was played off each other, the ideas. Oh, and he found this person, the model, he's some professional, and he was going to him and saying, oh, can we use you as a model for this sculpture? And I was sure. And as I said, you know, constraints are for me really exciting. So I said, why don't you guys get a high quality 3D scan? And then we see if that makes sense to do something from that. And so they did that at a university there somewhere. And I got the files and I was like, wow, he has his eyes closed. I never ever made a sculpture with eyes closed. That's really irritating. It took me like a week to really get over it and realize just how much I love it, because he is looking into himself. And I was like, oh, that's just perfect. So then new for this piece was that we actually made something that has been evolving over time into a pretty far-reaching evolution. We put light system inside the plinth with programmable LED lighting that shines at an angle into the work through the base plate. So the base plate is just a rim, basically. And so it then zigzags, like I mentioned before, zigzags up and illuminates the whole piece from the inside. So over the last 3 or 4 public pieces where I've used light, I've gotten better and better at understanding what it is that I want and how can it be done. And then he added a sound element, which I was completely unaware of. And so he was like, what do you think about? And I had this idea of AC/DC, like somehow, like, but very quietly, but just the quint, 2, 1, and 5 together as a tone. And he was like, oh yeah, I was thinking something like this. So, but now he made something totally different. And I haven't been there in person, but I really want to see it. So it's very quiet, but it's going to be intriguing to see how it influences your perception of it.
So along with some of the portraits and other things, do you have any major projects in the works that you would like to share?
What am I doing right now? Yeah, there's one really interesting piece. Actually, there's 4 pieces. One is 4 real portraits of real people. It's a client who has 4 children. They're 18 to 25 or something. And I went 3D scanned them and actually went back because we wanted to change something with the hair. And so they are real portraits, like in the old days, like a king commissioned a painter to do a portrait of his children. It's exactly like this. It's very accurate. It's very beautiful. For me, a total fun, because I also, when I was painting, I would love to draw a portrait. There's something amazing about that transformation when you try to be very faithful to something in front of you. And if you want it or not, it does something, it gets transformed. It's abstract by necessity and becomes this work of art that has a new quality. And that's really exciting to me. The other one is actually a group. It's a 10-foot tall piece for Columbus, Ohio. And that is a group of 5 grown-ups, 1 child and 1 chicken, which is for a social justice park in Columbus. That's an intriguing piece I'm doing with my wife. She's the social justice person in my family. So it was a natural fit. So I'm excited. That's the first time we actually do a sculpture together, but it's almost done now. I think we'll install it in December or January.
Sounds great. I'd like to thank you so much for taking the time to share your fascinating story and valuable insight with our audience. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and we wish you continued success.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. That was renowned sculptor Julian Voss Andres being with us from Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.